Thank you, and welcome. Nice to be here again. So, as a question or specific concern that they would like to have explored in this satsang, you can always post it here. You can in the comment board, or you can raise your hand if you're on the live site. And also, I'll mention again that you can email it to me at satsang.com. And then I will have a little time to ponder what you asked about. But I'm also open to just springing it on me here in the moment, and I'm happy to answer it. And as always, I also have something I can speak about if there's no questions arising right now for anyone. So no pressure. And what I thought I'd speak about and explore today is the whole topic of self-inquiry, which is a spiritual practice most typically associated with Ramana Maharshi. He was a spiritual master in India back in the first half of the 20th century. And that was his main teaching. Though the story goes that whenever anybody came to him, he would talk to them about whatever was their practice. And it was only when they asked him, what's the best practice? Spiritual practice in general, actually I don't even like that word, though it's of course the one that's used the most commonly. And I like to think of it more as play, spiritual play. When I was a kid, my parents made me take piano lessons, and I hated practicing. I had to, practice a half hour a day, and it was like this huge burden. When I got home from school, I just wanted to run, go outside or do something else, and I always had to, force myself to practice the piano. And then finally, they let me quit taking piano lessons. And a few years went by, and then I was at this kind of summer arts camp, and I one time found myself in a big room, a big auditorium kind of room, and up on stage was a beautiful grand piano. And I just went up on the stage and I started fooling around with the piano. I started playing what I could still remember that I had learned, and just making noises and seeing how many keys of the piano I could strike at the same time if I used my whole arm to play them. And I lifted up the lid on the grand piano and played it like a guitar. And so I just played. I discovered that I liked playing the piano. As much as I didn't like practicing the piano, I actually liked playing the piano. So I'd like to suggest that without you can still be sincere and give your all to your spiritual play, but it doesn't have to be a burden. It doesn't have to be an obligation. It can be something that you just explore for its own sake. That's why I actually, after that experience with the grand piano, I spent years playing the piano. I just refused to ever practice it. And I discovered that I liked playing the piano for its own sake. I just didn't like preparing and trying to get somewhere by playing the piano. So the same approach to spiritual practice, again, I'll use the word just because that's the word we use, but if you approach it more as play, it actually gives it more breadth, it actually captures more of the essence of what it's really all about right from the start. If you're just playing with the experience of meditation, if you're just playing with even yoga or any kind of playing with being silent for a day or for a week, just to see what you could discover, playing with your inner wisdom, playing with form, someone just typed. So that's the first thing I would say about spiritual practice in general. Another thing about spiritual practice in general that's, I think, really, really helpful. I've mentioned it on these recordings already. There's this kind of expectation, maybe some people have an expectation that spiritual practices, good spiritual practices, should work for anybody that encounters them. And my good friend Jeffrey Martin, is a neuroscientist who's done remarkable research over the last 15 years on awakening and on this whole spiritual and experience of realization. He definitely, spiritual practices that he calls them gold standard practices. They're ones that seem to work well in a lot of cases, and yet even with those gold standard spiritual practices, he found that they were only effective in about 5% of the people, 5 to 6% of the people that encountered them. That's a pretty low success rate. If you stop and think about it, that means only about 1 in 20 people at the local meditation group or spiritual practice center, spiritual teaching center, that only about 1 in 20 of them is it actually a match. Does it actually fit for that person? And the challenge in that, one of the challenges in that, is that, of course, it's not so much of a challenge if you stumble upon the one that really fits for you. If you happen to encounter a spiritual practice and you're one of the 5 or 6% that works for, then you're good. There's no difficulty in that, and it's wonderful. Those are those great stories of people that have made tremendous spiritual progress in a very short amount of time, because they just stumbled upon a practice that really fit for them. And the difficulty or the challenge is that there are 19 out of 20 people in the room with that person for whom it's not such a great fit. It's just like not everyone needs the same medicine. Not everyone likes the same music. Not everyone responds the same way to certain kinds of literature or music. And so the other 19 people in the room, will not experience as much effect from the practice. And also, which makes it even tougher, that they will see the one or two people in the room or, in the group for whom the practice is working like a charm. And so they'll say, well, see, it obviously works. Zen meditation is the path and is the key. And I just need to do it, 4 or 6 or 8 hours a day instead of 2 hours a day. And then I would start to have the experiences that so-and-so is having. And to a degree, there's a truth in that, because one of the things that Jeffrey Martin did observe is that if somebody really stuck with a spiritual practice, I mean, in this we're talking years, if they just really applied themselves with total dedication, that even if it had very little effect on them at the beginning, that eventually it's almost like they would be changed in order to fit the practice. They would, gradually adopt a new relationship to the practice. But again, it could take years before it actually started to have a profound effect on them. And so he did encounter people who didn't experience much for years, but just kept doing whatever practice it was, and then eventually it started working for them. But it's just a much more effective, efficient, functional approach to recognize that not every practice is going to have a profound effect on you. And so if you find one that does, stick with it. If you find one that does, after you've been doing it for, you can often tell even within a few weeks whether a spiritual practice is a good fit for you. You will either immediately start to have nice experiences during the practice, and I'm talking about all the different forms of meditation, self-inquiry, breathing practices, the headless way, if you're not familiar with that one. There are different forms of, they're almost like mantra practices where you, where different kinds of affirmations, different Christian practices, including just good old, you know, going to a revival meeting and getting up front and asking Jesus into your heart. That surprisingly works with about 5% of the people that do it, and they have a profound and authentic spiritual experience. They are filled with, well, I guess in Christianity they won't call it Shakti, but they are filled with divine presence, and it changes their lives forever. So, you know, if you're open to that kind of thing, if you're drawn in that direction, you might as well give it a try. And the point being that whatever practice or practices that you try, that you should be able to tell fairly quickly if they are going to work for you. And if not, you can just let them go. You can always come back to them another time, because sometimes you've changed and it now is a better fit. Another subtle point is that even if you find a practice that fits for you, over time that can change you. Even when it works, it can change you, and so it becomes less of a fit over time. So it's always wonderful. Again, this comes back to the metaphor of making it into spiritual play instead of a chore, a task, a obligation, but instead something that you just play with and explore. I mean, if you're just playing the piano, you don't necessarily spend a lot of time playing songs or pieces of music that you don't like or that don't fit for you, or that make you, you know, make you depressed or something like that. Instead, you would, you know, gravitate to the music that you love to play, that it just fits for you. It just, like, oh, it just opens your heart. You just feel alive when you're playing it. And the same thing is true with these spiritual forms of play or practice. So, you know, be willing to keep trying, including, you know, what I'm going to speak about. And this is, again, I want to stress again that if at any time someone has a question, just jump right in. Because actually what I'm going to talk about today is a big enough topic that I'll probably just keep talking about it for the next, couple sessions after this. So there's no hurry, there's nowhere to get to. And so if your question is burning or just pops into your mind, then please share it with the group and we'll see where that goes. But back to this, I was going to say, this whole idea of not every spiritual practice works for everybody, the same thing is true of self-inquiry, of this whole, I actually often just use the word inquiry, this whole process of inner exploration, inner questioning, inner curiosity that I'm going to talk about some today. And then the last thing I was just going to say about spiritual practice, and this is again very in a very general sense, all spiritual practices, which is that they don't actually do anything. I'm letting out a little secret here. Spiritual practice is not, the results aren't up to you. And so what spiritual practice or play in general does is it makes you more available to the movement of divine grace. It makes you more available to the, you could also call it divine intelligence if you're not familiar with or comfortable with the word grace. There's a presence, wisdom, a knowing that permeates life, and it is always available, and yet we're not always available to it. And so the, you know, practice, the play that we do in the whole spiritual journey is not actually intended to cause some particular result. It's a very indirect process, And nothing you can do can actually will actually cause you know, some kind of opening, shift, energetic unfolding. The cause is always this divine intelligence. The cause is always this divine intelligence, knowing when it's time and knowing what needs to happen now. So the best we can do by doing practices, yes, someone said it sensitizes us. Another that's one way of putting it. That's actually, I've never said it that way, but that's a really wonderful way of putting it. It sensitizes you. It also just, in a sense, makes you available to divine grace, to this divine intervention that kind of strikes you out of the blue. And yet you can make yourself more available to it. I often use the metaphor that if you go to the beach, there's nothing you can do to cause a tsunami. There's no spiritual practice, there's no ritual, there's no, you can build a big bonfire, you can sacrifice a lot. However, if you spend a lot of time at the beach, sitting right down at the water's edge, then the chances that you will experience a tsunami go way up. And in fact, if you're right at the water's edge, it may not even require a tsunami. It may just require a rogue wave, an unusually big wave, or the coming in of the tide. And someone just typed in, then we think we caused it to happen. Yeah, there's a illusion that happens when you do a lot of spiritual practice and you start having these profound spiritual experiences. You think you caused it. You feel like, oh, you know, I did it. I caused that to happen. And no, you just made yourself available. And it'd be like, you know, taking a lot of credit for a big wave that knocked you over. And so that's the invitation. In this spiritual practice or play, is to simply put yourself into your own experience. It's the metaphor of being right at the water's edge, so a big wave or the incoming tide can find you. In this case, you're putting yourself in touch with what is moving in your being, what is happening in the present moment, through meditation, through inquiry, through these focusing practices, these awareness practices. They're pointing you to something that's already here. And it's that causes any shift or any what we might call profound results from our spiritual practice. So that all being said, you know, again, you approach it with a sense of play. Be willing to try different spiritual practices to find one that fits, and then recognize that ultimately the results are not up to you. All of that allows you to approach it all very lightly. That is happening. It is the practice making me, starting to make me available to more of the subtle, smaller and bigger waves of my being? Or is it somehow paradoxically taking me away? Is it wrapping me up? You know, sometimes people get very wrapped up in the practice, and that's sort of like, you know, pushing yourself to practice the piano. You can push yourself to do the practice till people end up with having to have knee surgery because they sat too long in meditation of their personal will that it will get them somewhere. But if you recognize these principles, that you can approach it as play, that there are practices that fit and practices that don't fit, and then to hold lightly any question of results, it's strange because it's like taking your hands off the spiritual steering wheel, And yet, that's when you discover that the car, the vehicle, your own being knows the way. So that all being said, like I said, I'm gonna, and again, unless someone jumps in with a question, I'm gonna jump in myself with talking a little bit about self-inquiry, about the practice, the play of self-inquiry. And to do that, I'm gonna actually read from an article that's on my website. And I know I've always had problems posting links. The system doesn't let me post links on here. So what I did is I just posted the address of the article in case some people like to read along, and some people might want to refer to it later after because I'll be reading some and commenting some. But if you just put the half a link that I put up there that says the practice and purpose of self-inquiry, if you just copy that and put it at the end of my website address, which is endless-satsang.com, and maybe even Cheryl can just put those two things together, endless-satsang.com/ the practice and purpose of self-inquiry.htm. That's kind of the framework, the reference that I'm going to read from and speak about. And so that's the title of the article. And I'll just start reading, jump in right here, start reading. At first, the spiritual practice of self-inquiry is just that, inquiry. It is turning our attention and curiosity inwards towards the truth of our nature. It is a practice of redirecting attention away from objects, events, and experiences, and towards the experiences within your own body and being. In fact, I would say towards the experiencer within your body and being, including very subtle experiences or very subtle dimensions of the experiencer. This inward focus can lead to an experience of your true nature and even beyond experience itself, to a dimension that is empty of any experience or sense of self, to deeper realities that are beyond description. So I just say here that my teacher Neelam, or actually she quoted Ramana on her website, and she quoted him as saying that the purpose of self-inquiry is not to get an answer to the question. The purpose of self-inquiry is to dissolve the questioner. So that's a very, very different purpose than we're kind of used to. It's like, really, what is the purpose of going to the beach and experiencing a tsunami when that could be the end of the experiencer, the end of the person who is seeking to drown? And so that's you know, strangely enough, that's the ultimate effect that any spiritual practice can have on you. And so that's why this article says it, that inquiry can take you to deeper realities beyond your experience of self, or beyond description. The practice of inquiry can be quite simple. You begin by simply asking, who am I? Or what am I? Or even what is here right now? You can use any question that directs your attention to your sense of me, or even more fundamentally, to your experience of existence or of existing. If your attention is flowing to an outer sensation or experience, you can ask, to whom is this sensation or experience happening? This is sort of the alternative form of the question, who am I? Or a secondary question, when your attention starts to wander, you ask, to whom is this sensation happening? To whom is this thought happening? To whom is this emotion happening? Any of those, whatever you notice in your experience, then you ask, well, to whom is this experience arising? And the obvious answer is, it's happening to me. It's kind of too obvious, and so we overlook it, but if you really take that in for a minute, it's happening to me. And then you can come back to the first series of questions, who am I or what am I? If it's happening to me, who is this me? What is this me? Repeating these questions as each new experience or each new sense of me arises takes the experience more and more deeply into the inner aspects of your being. Sometimes you can just repeat the first question, who am I, what am I, who am I, what am I, and especially if you let go of the sense, again, of you're having to make something happen, that there's a right answer or anything of that sort, if you just offer that question up, feelings, impulses, desires, intuitions, and subtler experiences happening all the time. All of these, strangely, can seem like they are me, or at least a part of me, or at least happening to me in such an intimate and direct way that that gives us a sense of ourself, a sense of me. When we first ask, who or what am I, we are likely to first notice our body. So the answer is simply, I am this body. Who or what am I? I'm this body. Or we might notice a particular aspect of the body. And so the answer might be, I'm a woman, or I'm a man, or I'm 5 feet 8 inches tall, or I am blonde. And although these are fairly obvious and superficial answers, they are all correct and true. One bit of good news is that in doing inquiry, there are no wrong answers. Anything you can experience or notice about yourself is part of the truth of yourself. I mean, I'll just interject here that if ultimately we are one with everything, then no matter where you look, you're doing inquiry. No matter what you experience, you are experiencing an aspect of yourself. You're experiencing an aspect of the one self. So that's the sense in which there's no wrong answers. Wherever the question leads, that's where it directs your attention in that moment. Now, if we notice the body or any aspect of the body, then we can inquire more deeply to discover more. And one way to do this is to ask, if I am more than this body, then who or what am I? Or if I am more than a woman or a man, then who or what am I? So this is, without making the first answer wrong or denying its truth, we simply ask, what else is true? What else is here besides what I first noticed? And then whatever answer comes next, you can ask again, if I am more than that, who or what am I? So this is similar to the earlier I spoke about the kind of cycle of questions. Who am I? And then if your attention goes to a sensation or a thought or an experience, then you say, to whom is this sensation or experience happening? And it brings you back to the sense of me. And then you say, who is that? What is that? What is me? Or who am I? And so this is a similar kind of cycle of questions, that no matter what specifics arise in your experience, you can ask a second question. You can then, in a sense, expand the view. So even if it's something fairly subtle, you can, what am I? I am seeing. I am the seeing of this room, I mean. Then the next question can be, if you are more than the seeing, what are you? So in this cycle of questions, we may find another answer that is a different aspect of our physical body, or we might find an answer that is more subtle, which points to a different level of our experience of self. For example, we may say, I am a plumber, or I am a spiritual seeker. These are not fixed qualities of our physical bodies, but rather potential actions or functions of our whole being. Or we may notice an identity, capacity, emotion, belief, thought, or desire. And if we are identified with it, we will say, I am depressed, or I am a great success, or I am a funny guy, or I am free, I am enlightened, I am intelligent. And again, there are no wrong answers. But you can always then ask, if I am more than that, what am I? It's really interesting, especially with an emotion. I am depressed. If you are more than that, what are you? I am a success. If you are more than that, what are you? I don't know if you can sense that, feel into that, how it continuously, without any resistance, without creating any resistance, without making any answer wrong, it points to the possibility of a bigger, more complete experience of yourself. And so in this self-inquiry, you can, there's no end to it really. And asking these questions naturally uncovers deeper and more subtle levels of your being. I see someone jumped in with a question. They said, is there a difference between who and what we are? And that's why I like to, as I go into this, and again, it may spill over into the next couple sessions, I like that there are many forms to the question. So the most simple variation is the variation between who am I and what am I? And both of those questions imply something. The first one implies that you're a who, that you are somebody, that you are, I think most people would assume that it implies that you are a person. You're a who, you're a particular person. Versus what am I? It has a different implication. I often really prefer the question, what am I? Because there's less of an assumption there. There's a whole, I think, wider range of potential assumed that I'm a person. What am I? Leaves the door open for the answer to come from anywhere. You know, as I just said, I am seeing. And that's much more undefined. It's not a who, you know. It's not like a, you know, it's not a name on my driver's license, seeing. It's a process. It's a aspect of awareness. It's a physical sensory mechanism. It's a, you know, and that's not a who. And someone just jumped in with a, how about I am what I am? And he said, this seems to point to something deeper and implies ownership of sorts. Does this make sense? I would say just like there's no wrong answers to the questions, there's no wrong questions. There's no, in fact, ultimately, I find that inquiry, if it's done in this kind of open, lighthearted, and yet sincere way, it naturally spreads out. It spreads out into every aspect of experience, into every depth and dimension of our being. And there is a depth, a dimension of our being where it's sort of one way of trying to capture it. It's hard to capture in words, but is to call it pure existence. I am what I am. And in fact, the example, I am what I am, is a statement. It's not a question. You're not, you know, I don't see it. You know, there's no question mark in that name when you say I am what I am. But it can still be a pointer. It can still be at a certain depth a wonderful form of this inquiry to what I am and sense. Later on in what I wrote, I get into all the different ways that you can play with these questions, all the different ways you can say them. Like one, put in here that one of the forms that I really enjoy is instead of asking the question, who am I or what am I like to just ask, am I? I strip the question down to its bare bones. Am I? And again, that's a whole different set of assumptions that are kind of stripped out of the question. It's simply asking, do I exist? Is there an I at all? And that, instead of like, am I a who or am I, points to another dimension, another depth of our being, which is actually even beyond existence. Or it can, again, it's like taking you right to that water's edge. That big a wave that's empty even of existence, will come in when you make yourself available by the question, am I? So any statement, any question that directs your attention inward, and especially at first, inward is, it's called inquiry, so it's inward exploration. And that's just in general, that's the best direction to start, because most of us already give a lot of attention to our environment and to, and by the way, including when I say your attention going outward, I'm including all the thoughts and feelings and desires and fears and doubts and worries and even the physical sensations of your body, because relative to the sense of self, those are all outer experiences. And so this practice at first is a directing attention inward. Ultimately, as you go deeper and deeper into yourself, there you can reach this kind of paradoxical point where you find it all equally rich, equally fascinating, even your own thoughts, even a feeling of fear or a feeling of depression. I'll share a little story. I was, this was almost 20 years ago now. I had gotten back from India and was invited for the first time to give satsang at a friend's house up in Seattle. Somebody who had traveled with us to India. And one day he asked me, he said, hey Nirmala, how would you like to come to my house and give satsang? And I'll make sure lots of people could come, because I have a group up there that he had a group that he ran. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. And he didn't know this, but when he said, make sure that a lot of people come, he didn't know that I'd had a lifelong fear of public speaking. A lifelong paralyzing fear of public speaking. It was just like the most intense fear and terror that I would experience is anytime I had to speak in front of a group. And so him telling me that there would be a lot of people there was probably, it was meant to be, but it was quite a challenge at the time. And so I drove with him up to Seattle, and the night came, and I was sitting in his kitchen alone, eating my dinner a couple hours before satsang. And instead of it happening when I got in front of the group of people, the fear came right then and there. I suddenly had this huge wave of self-doubt of, who am I to give satsang? Who am I kidding? I'll probably, pass out and pee my pants, and that'll be, it'll be the most ridiculous satsang ever. And, I had this tremendous, tremendous wave of anxiety and fear. So much so that I thought I was going to pass out. The room started spinning. It was just a full-blown something in me. And just said, okay, fine, whatever. If I do pass out, if I do pee my pants, if this is the only satsang that I ever give because it's such a disaster, fine. I just totally surrendered, said, that's great. If that's what happens, that's fine. And in that moment, the what I would say is the driver of the fear completely dissolved. And actually never came back. Sometimes I would get a little nervous when I had to speak, but even that evening, I wasn't that nervous. So the driver of the of that fear dissolved in that moment. What was interesting, though, is that the emotion was still running through my body. Fear, you know, fear has a lot of neurochemicals involved with it, adrenaline, all these other, you know, like I said, I was the room was starting to spin, and my palms were sweating. I was almost going to pass out and fall face first in my dinner. And so that wasn't gone. The fear itself, in a sense, was gone, but the whole sensation, yeah, the fight or flight response of my whole being was still going really strong. Just like if you, the classic story of if you, you know, see a stick in the path and you think it's a snake, your heart starts to race, you jump, you scream, then you realize it's a stick. However, it still takes a little while for your body to settle down, for you to get over the shock, over the fear. And so that's what was happening. I was sitting there, I was totally fine with whatever happened, and yet my body was, my head was spinning, my, you know, there were all these incredible sensations. And then this sense of inquiry, this sense of like, huh, this is wild, wow. In fact, I started, it was so intense. I mean, again, like I said, it was like a full-blown panic attack, so it wasn't just a mild sensation. There were intense sensations running through my whole body. But I was suddenly just really curious about them. Like, wow, this is like better than a roller coaster. This is like, I can just sit here in a chair in a room by myself and have a bigger, stronger, wilder experience than if I went to an amusement park. And so I just enjoyed the intensity of sensations that were running through my body. And so I think I got in the story because my suggestion is that ultimately, along with inquiry, we can do, I guess you could call it outquiry. You could just, the exploration of whatever arises. And so the it's the one type I can freak myself out for free. Exactly. And so, but it's a rich experience if you bring this kind of, it's, I guess I'd call it more like an attitude of inquiry to everything. At first, it's definitely, you know, helpful to do self-inquiry, to do inward-directed inquiry towards your sense of self. Then, with time, you'll discover that that same attitude of inquiry can be applied to any aspect of your experience, any dimension of existence, and it will be rich, it will be worthwhile to explore in that way. So, picking up the reading, asking those questions naturally uncovers deeper and more subtle levels of our being. While at first, you might find that the answers relate a lot to your physical nature and the bundle of thoughts, identities, capacities, actions, feelings, desires, habits, and conditioning that make up what we call the individual, after a while, you might find that the answers that come relate to more essential aspects of your nature. You may have a sense in that moment that you are the peace, joy, love, compassion, or any of the more essential qualities that underlie our superficial nature. And so this, you know, like I just said, you can direct it outwardly, but there turns out there's a whole universe inward. And so, you know, whether it's inward directed or outward directed doesn't ultimately matter, but for most of us, there's a whole lot of stuff we haven't discovered inward. It's so endless that in that direction. Though of course it's also pretty endless when you go outward, especially if you include the even when you uncover a deeper truth, you can always still ask if I am even more than infinite peace, then who or what am I? This is another, just like it gets really interesting when you're just curious about the kind of everyday experiences or the outer experiences of life or the emotions or thoughts or, you know, those kinds of processes as they unfold. It's also really interesting to just keep going in the inward direction even when you come to something, back to the metaphor of going to the beach in order to expose yourself to the tsunami, even when the tsunami comes, even when there's a huge wave of peace, a huge wave of joy, a huge sense of liberation or freedom or realization or knowing or oneness, to then dive even deeper. Especially when if you experience those more often, you know, if you start having experiences, any kinds of deeper experiences, to also play with this possibility to be willing to ask the question, if I am even more than infinite peace, then who or what am I? Talk about, you know, a big question, right? Even more than infinite peace. As the process unfolds, you may move more deeply into the truth of your being. You might experience a very fundamental quality of all being, such as awareness, empty spaciousness, or oneness. These are qualities of everything throughout eternity. Everywhere you go, there is space. Everything that exists has consciousness or awareness. And everything is connected and actually one thing or one being. So these qualities that I'm describing here, awareness, empty spaciousness, oneness, they're fundamental qualities that are, when your inquiry uncovers even a fundamental quality of existence, that is just another dimension to be discovered, explored, and you can still inquire further. If I am more than pure awareness, what am I? So even when the experiences opens up and starts to be emptier and emptier of specific qualities and fuller of these fundamental qualities of space and oneness and awareness, it's also still possible to direct. So back to my little metaphor, even after you dive into the tsunami and start swimming out into the ocean, at any point you can also turn and just towards the bottom. As crazy as that might seem, when especially in the metaphor, when you might run out of air before you get back to the surface, but in the case of your being, there's no risk, there's no threat. The deeper you go into, the richer it gets. So if I am more than pure awareness, what am I? If I am more than oneness with everything, what am I? If I am more than infinite space, what am I? More than infinite space. Let's take that in, infinite space. What am I? The deeper and more subtle layers that get uncovered in inquiry have more reality and impact on your being, especially when you first uncover them, than the more superficial layers of the body, mind, and personality. So even though they are not physical or solid in the usual sense, they are more real and substantial. This becomes obvious anytime you experience your essence or the fundamental qualities of existence itself. The impact of the experience is beyond anything that you can experience in the more relative levels of your existence in the physical world. So that's, things get more real, things get more impactful, more intense in some way, to just recognize that that's normal, that's the right way for them to feel, because it can be, a little unfamiliar, a little, maybe even a little frightening if you're, because it's unfamiliar, a little surprising at how intense the experiences can get. And yet the inquiry, it's working, it's uncovering more of the truth of your being, or making you available to it anyways, so that it uncovers itself. These more fundamental levels are also simply bigger. True peace and joy are infinite. Space has no limit. Pure awareness or consciousness is eternal. As a result, when your inquiry uncovers such a vast dimension of your true nature, it no longer really makes sense to call it me. The words I and me just don't compute when you experience yourself as all space and all time. It can help at these points in the process to allow the questions to become more open-ended and undefined. For instance, it might make more sense to ask questions such as, what boundaries are there to peace? What is here right now? What is happening now? What is true about awareness in this moment? Or to just hold in an open questioning attention that takes in as much of what is present as possible with no words as needed. So you just hold your present moment experience in this open questioning attention. Obviously, an indefinable, wordless experience of limitless true nature is a very valid discovery when doing inquiry. Inquiry can lead to moments where all of our usual concepts and experiences are no longer relevant, and the world and our entire sense of self can dissolve completely. There is no way to really describe this kind of non-experience in words, but it is a possible result of going deeper and deeper with more and more open-ended inquiry. So that's pointing to kind of the ultimate dimension of inquiry. And next week, when I pick this up, I'll talk some about how that's one possibility. You know, there, you could be at the beach and experience the mother of all tsunamis, and your world could never be the same again. Tsunami that washes over the entire continent and changes everything in an instant. And that's one depth, one dimension of our being, of our reality that is sometimes uncovered, that sometimes shows up when you hang out at the beach of spiritual practice or spiritual inquiry. And that usually it's a strange kind of tsunami, because we're talking about these very subtle levels. Even though they change everything, they also don't change a thing. The arising of a sense of pure consciousness or a total experience of oneness with everything changes your recognition, and yet it doesn't actually change anything at all. And so, you know, when you then get up from your practice of inquiry or your practice of meditation, you discover that your bladder is full and you still need to go to the bathroom. You discover your stomach still feels hunger and you need to eat, and you can even still go to work and relate to your family members and drive a car and all the and also everything in between those very practical physical dimensions of reality and this total spacious emptiness of beyond existence, beyond experience. Everything in between, all the subtle levels of what, you know, in the most general sense is labeled as spiritual. All the different kinds of experiences, psychic experiences and different, heart-opening experiences and magical, mystical, mysterious experiences that make up all the other dimensions in between. And so when I pick up next week, those of you who happen to or do end up looking in my article, you'll see that the next section is called The Maps of Reality and the Purpose of Inquiry. And so it kind of points to how in some maps, the purpose of inquiry is to get to that biggest reality, to, in a sense, dissolve all illusion. And somehow it's expected that that will be a permanent effect. But I tend to see the purpose of inquiry really is just the discovery and exploration of all these different dimensions to, in a sense, end up with a more complete map. of reality. So, AT assistant said, what would you like to title this satsang? Cheryl said that I would like to call this Introduction to Self-Inquiry Part 1, since it's going to obviously continue. And next week I'll know whether it's Part 2, is the last part, or whether there'll be a Part 3. But for this week, it's Introduction to Self-Inquiry Part 1. And we'll take it from there when we meet again next Wednesday. So thank you all. It's always a pleasure to just sense the sharing, the connection, even through the wires.